Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
An exciting show for you this week as we welcome identity theft expert Robert Siciliano to the show to explain how important it is to protect yourself when it comes to your personal information online and on your mobile devices. We then welcome a new member to the team, our music editor, Sharon Hyland, to talk about older musicians like Mick Jagger and Elton John teaming up with hot young producers who are bringing them a whole new audience. We also chat about accessible travel with Candy Harrington and showcase a new remix from Madonna, Turn Up the Radio.
Capture your need for sound.
In today's digital age, we do our banking over the phone and our shopping online. We chat over webcams and share photos and all kinds of personal information on social networks like Facebook and Twitter. But how can we be sure that our information is safe? Here to help us navigate the complex world of digital security and hacking is personal security and identity theft expert Robert Siciliano. Robert, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much.
So, Robert, what kind of personal information are hackers most likely to steal?
Ideally, they're looking for identifying digits, such as the social security number. In Canada, it's the social insurance number. And in general, these nine digits are used to open up new financial accounts, like bank accounts and credit card accounts under your name. That's new account fraud. And then they like usernames and passwords for existing accounts to take over those existing accounts, like bank accounts or even your existing credit card numbers. They use that to make unauthorized charges against your existing accounts.
Now, so many of us bank, you know, and shop online. How can we make sure that we're doing it safely?
First and foremost, make sure that your mobile has security software, because if you're shopping via your mobile, it is just as susceptible today to viruses as your PC is. And then, of course, for your PC, you want to make sure that you have antivirus, anti-spyware, anti-phishing, and a firewall, making sure that the software is updated annually, meaning that you annually pay for your license, and that you're constantly downloading and updating your virus definitions automatically.
And with regards to Macs, because I know there's always this thing where people say Macs can't get viruses. Is that actually true or not?
So Macs, there was a day when they did not get viruses, or they were much less susceptible. Today, they are more susceptible, that there are viruses being created on a daily basis specifically towards the Macs, that Mac users are no longer safe and secure, they're no longer immune, that they need to make sure that they also have updated antivirus, anti-spyware, anti-phishing, and a firewall as well.
Joining us on the show is personal security and identity theft expert Robert Siciliano. Make sure to check him out at McAfee.com. Robert, how important is it to, you know, update and upgrade our digital technology?
So the criminals are continually looking for the path of least resistance. They are looking for vulnerabilities in your operating system. They're looking for outdated browsers. They're looking for old, outdated technology that they can exploit, where they can slither a worm through and they can get your personal information. So it's always essential to have the latest, greatest hardware that generally is accompanied by the latest, greatest software. So I'm a big believer in shedding old devices and upgrading to the new ones, and that generally includes upgrading to the new software as well.
And when you talk about hardware, what are you talking about?
So you have, you know, old Windows XP machines, you know, old laptops and desktops, even netbooks that function in an XP environment, and XP is no longer, soon it will no longer be supported by Microsoft. So if you were to upgrade to a Windows 7 machine, so a newer box, you know, like a newer Dell or a new Lenovo and so forth, generally the hardware and, again, accompanies the software, it's more secure. And the same thing with old mobile phones, old smartphones, like the first and second generation of smartphones compared to the new ones that are coming out today, those older ones are much more vulnerable than today's smartphones.
And what's your opinion on how to dispose of these older models? Because I think a lot of people are always frightened that some of their information is still on these machines when they get rid of them.
Yeah, really good question. I actually bought 30 devices off of Craigslist. I bought laptops and desktops and mobile phones and so forth, and I ran them through a forensics expert, and he was able to find information on half the devices, meaning that the people who had reformatted or reinstalled the operating systems still left data lingering on those machines and those devices, which would allow somebody to steal their identity. Generally, what I recommend is going through the manufacturer's recommendations as to what to do to bring the device back to factory settings. And again, that usually means reinstalling the operating system or reformatting the drive or resetting something to bring it back to factory. And again, you can learn about all that just by doing a search on the device and how to reinstall the operating system. But beyond that, I would never let a hard drive or even a mobile phone out of my possession even after it was reformatted a bunch of times. What I would recommend that people do is they recycle the box itself, you know, it's like the laptop or the desktop, but take the hard drive out and destroy it, which means hitting the sledgehammer multiple times, drilling holes through it, and even dropping it in a bucket of salt water for a year. And while that may sound extreme, if you realize that, you know, by donating or recycling or reselling a secondhand device for $50, you're essentially, you know, selling your identity for $50 as well.
I'm really glad that you explained that, Robert, because I think a lot of people are very, you know, easy to just, oh, I'm just going to recycle it, and then they don't realize that all their information is still on these devices.
Yeah, they really are. And when I did this study, I did it because, you know, for a number of reasons of doing it with McAfee, and that we wanted to find out what kind of information was on there, especially viruses too, because there was viruses on those devices that we bought in the secondhand market as well. And I often, you know, buy and sell stuff on Craigslist, you know, just for my own personal use, you know, sell my own old devices. And when I saw the results of our research, I was astounded, and I will never, ever part with the secondhand device ever again. I was shocked, and it takes a lot to shock me.
And what's your opinion on getting rid of laptops? Because I know that seems to be a harder thing, I think, to deal with to get rid of it.
You know, that's a good question as well. And while desktops are much easier just to open up and pull the drive out, laptops can be a little more difficult, but it's not that much more difficult. With a Phillips head screwdriver and a quick search online how to remove hard drive from whatever the name of the laptop is and the model number, anybody with a Phillips head screwdriver can effectively do it. It's really not that difficult.
Okay, fantastic and great advice. And I wanted to ask you as well, when it comes to all these social networks like Facebook and Twitter, everyone seems so open to just, you know, verbally or you know, just vomiting out their information to everyone. So what do these, you know, social networks and peer-to-peer file sharing programs, how do they play into the hackers' hands?
In a word, as far as social media goes, I think everybody should just shut up, right? I think they're saying way too much. I think that they're getting themselves in trouble, and for a number of different reasons. They're damaging their online reputations, which essentially is their reputation in the physical world, and that can bring upon all kinds of problems with getting jobs and getting into schools, and it causes fights, and it leads to bullying and all kinds of stuff. So I think that people should really just, you know, pull back what they're saying. While we've been living in the fishbowl for quite some time, people really need to tone it down. It causes a lot of problems. And then your identity can be compromised as well. So what you put online lives forever, and the name of your kids and your pets and your birth dates and your favorite foods and the places you visit and all that stuff is often associated with the passwords that we use. And bad guys are getting really good at fishing out that information and cracking the passwords of your different accounts. So as long as you're putting all this information out there, which is the same information that could be answered via the knowledge-based questions that are asked of you when you sign up for a new account, and they say, well, what's your mother's maiden name? So if you forget your password in the future, we can, you know, help you reset it, but we need to know what your mother's maiden name is right now. And if your Facebook account is, you know, Mary Smith Jones and your maiden name is, you know, Smith, then that's a problem.
Right. And it's very simple for you, like you said, these bad guys to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit again about the difference between the mobile device and either your laptop or your desktop? Because I think so many people just forget how susceptible their mobile device can be.
The difference is blurring, meaning that, you know, it used to be that your laptop, that your desktop was your main device for computing, and then as laptops got cheaper, it became the laptop. You know, so less desktops are being sold and more laptops are being sold. Laptops have, you know, the same, if not bigger, hard drives than a lot of desktops today. And now what's happening is smartphones are replacing the laptop and the desktop, that more people actually have a smartphone today than they do a laptop or a desktop, which means that the smartphones have just as much, if not more, hard drive space than some laptops today. And so people are doing their online banking, all their social media, they're engaging in m-commerce, which is mobile commerce, buying stuff on the internet and so forth, using their mobile as a wallet today. And it's it has everybody's information on it. And a lot of people don't even have a passcode on it. So if they lost it, people would have direct access to their data, which is a huge problem. So number one, lock that device up so that if you lose it, somebody just can't access it. Also install something like McAfee Mobile Security, which has lost, locate, and wipe on it. So if you lose it, you can find it and, you know, locate it via its GPS, and you can also wipe it. You can wipe the data on it remotely. Not having something that locks, locates, and wipes the device today, I think it's pretty much irresponsible. And at a minimum, at least please have a passcode on that device as well.
What's your opinion, Robert, about this new thing, or I guess it's been around for several months now, where people are, you know, inputting their MasterCard and, you know, other credit card information on their phone and using it that way?
So that's as a mobile wallet, and I'm not opposed to that. There is definitely some benefits to that. It certainly is more convenient. As long as that device, again, is locked up, if you're using near-field communications, which is like radio frequencies via that device that you swipe it near something, or you scan a barcode within the device, whatever the case is, that technology is generally much more secure than, say, a regular credit card. A regular credit card with the magnetic stripe on the back is the least form of secured credit card that you can get. I know in Canada, rolling out chip and PIN. Chip and PIN is much more secure than the U.S.-based magnetic stripe card. And again, you know, the near-field communication wireless-type credit card built into your phone is actually as secure as a chip and PIN.
Okay, so that's good to know. Joining us on the show is personal security and identity theft expert Robert Siciliano. Check him out, McAfee.com. Can you explain what smishing is?
Smishing is when you get text messages via your mobile that are like a phish message that you might get via your computer. So, for example, on your computer, you might get an email that looks like it's coming from your bank saying that you have to update your password because there's been a problem with the system. And then once you click on the links within the body of that email, you start to enter your personal information and you're giving it to a bad guy. Those same links that you might be clicking could also be infected, which means that you're downloading something as a result of clicking on that link. And ultimately your PC gets compromised. Now, on a mobile phone, if you get that same email, but you really get it via text, that's called not a phish, but a smish, SMS phish. Smishing is text messages that we receive that look like it might be coming from AT&T, let's say, or your mobile carrier, saying, okay, it's time for you to update your operating system, click on this link, and you'll download something to your phone, essentially to upgrade and update your operating system. But in the reality, if you click on that text message in that link in that text, that smish, then essentially be downloading an executable, a file that infects your mobile device, allowing a bad guy to remotely control and access your information.
Now, when it comes to spamming, I actually had this happen to me the other day. I have never had my email account hacked before, and all of a sudden I woke up to my mobile device going insane because someone had got into my Yahoo account and, you know, sent out an email to all of my contacts, which I've never had, and I've had that account, you know, since the 90s, so it was very shocking to me. What can people do to deal with that?
Yeah, I've been seeing more and more of that. Make sure that whatever your email provider is, whether it's Gmail or Yahoo or Hotmail, that you go into the security settings. And in the security settings within all of your web-based email programs, there's usually some type of a redundant security setup that allows you to, say, get a text message before somebody changes your password or before you change your password. It might allow for you to plug in your mobile phone number so that you get some type of a phone call to verify that there's something changing with your account, or maybe even a secondary email address plugged into your email account, that in case you lose control of your account because your password is compromised, that you can use your other email account to actually get more control over that account in the future. So go into the security settings and see what your options are for that email provider to make sure that in the future, if in fact you are compromised, compromised, that you can quickly regain control over that again. The worst thing you can do right now is doing nothing and just hoping for the best, whereas the best thing you could do is be proactive with and put additional security that generally the email provider will have for you right now. It's just a matter of you doing the due diligence and making it happen.
And when they say change your password, is that enough? Obviously not.
So changing your password is, you know, what you would do if there was some type of a problem with your account. But that's always a good thing. But again, you know, going into the security settings and seeing what other additional settings there might be in the form of redundant ways in which the email provider can contact you, or redundant ways in which you can contact them in the event that something does happen and your account is taken over out of your control. You may not be able to reset the password in the future because somebody else has control over it. So again, that redundancy that I speak of will assist you going forward so that you can regain control.
When it comes to kids, what can parents actually do, you know, to make sure that their children are not putting themselves or the rest of the family at risk of identity theft?
First and foremost, have conversations with them, and I know that is old news to a lot of people, but you really do need to sit down with your kids and talk to them about their online lives. Their digital lives today are just as important as their life in the physical world, because they're one and the same for the new generations. Knowing what's going on in their online life is essential. You know, you would want to know what's going on with your child's friends and who they're socializing with and so forth. You want to know what they're doing on the internet. And one thing that you can do is get a program called McAfee Safe Eyes. And what McAfee Safe Eyes does is it allows the parent and child together to navigate the web in a way where parent and child set up McAfee Safe Eyes together. They look at all the different risks and pitfalls of the web, what the child needs to look out for, what the parent needs to be aware of, and it allows the parent and child together to set filters so that the child won't see certain things that they shouldn't see online. Like, you don't want a 12-year-old looking at hardcore violent pornography, certainly, and there's ways that you can block out that content. And then it also keeps the parent connected to the child's online life via text messaging, emails that the parent would receive via their own account to, again, keep track on what's going on in the child's online life.
And right now, what are some of the most common, I guess, security threats of 2012? And what do you think is going to happen in the years to come? Is it going to get worse, or do you think hopefully better, Robert?
Well, certainly things are getting worse. There's no question about that. Hackers are more efficient, more organized than they've ever been. The technology that they're using is equal to the technology that the good guys are using. And so it's going to get worse. And what's not happening is consumers aren't getting educated fast enough. They're not aware of what they need to do. Most people know enough about their digital devices to operate them, where they don't know enough to secure them. So the public's consumers' intelligence must, the security intelligence must increase, and then they also have to, care. They have to care more. They don't really care that much. You know, they don't think it's going to happen to them. They think it's going to happen to somebody else, but it's real, it's happening, and it's going to continue to happen until consumers get smarter. Companies like Intel and McAfee and others are also creating more security built into the device that would be more hands-off for the consumer. It's built into the chip opposed to requiring software. As stuff like that begins to roll out, it'll help consumers as well. There's more to do on behalf of the security community, and there's more to do in behalf of the public to secure our critical infrastructures and the web as a whole.
Now, in your new book, 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Your Identity Was Stolen, you actually break down, you know, computer fraud and identity theft so that it's much easier to digest. What are, I guess, the basic essentials of internet security so that we should be aware of this on a daily basis?
Thank you for bringing up the book. It is definitely something that you want to read. It's got 99 tips of everything that you need to know about identity theft and computer fraud and how to protect yourself. And that's really what you need to do, is kind of walk through each of these tips so that you understand all the different risks and pitfalls so that you're not like a sitting duck. You know, it's like anything else in life. If you want to know how to do something, you research it, you study it, you watch a YouTube video on it, you pick up a book on it, you watch a TV show on it, you know, you become learned. You study up on it. And it's the same thing with cybersecurity. You know, going forward, if you're going to bank online, if you're going to engage in using a credit card over the internet, if you're going to utilize a social media account, if you're going to do any of these things, you're going to store information on your own computer. You know, you want to know how to protect it, how to protect yourself, how to protect your family, how to protect your small business. And that's by, you know, reading a good book or taking a class or watching a TV show, whatever it is that you need to do. And it's just like riding a bike. You know, once you achieve that ability, that balance, then you'll know how to do it for the rest of your life.
And where can people actually get a copy of your book, Robert?
So they can find the 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Your Identity Was Stolen online at Amazon.com. You can also go to my own personal website at IDTheftSecurity.com. Again, that's IDTheftSecurity.com.
Robert, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's personal security and identity theft expert Robert Siciliano. And again, you can check him out, McAfee.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
As you know, we are big fans of music here on The Kelly Alexander Show, and I am thrilled to introduce you to a new member of our team. This lady lives and breathes music. She has programmed music for one of North America's premier rock stations, Shom 97.7 in Montreal, not to mention being a much-loved announcer on that same station, known by her fans as the Queen of Rock. She also has a wealth of knowledge in the pop music world and is a multi-instrumentalist. And no, she does not play the xylophone. Please welcome.
I didn't want to stop you.
Please welcome to the show, Miss Sharon Hyland. Sharon, welcome aboard the big program.
Thank you very much. I'm truly honored to be on this big program. I'm very proud of you as a friend for taking this to the level that you've taken it, and I'm really very pleased just to be a part of it. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And I have to tell you, this is the first time I've ever called it the big program, so maybe you're bringing out something.
No pressure.
Not at all. So I wanted to start off by asking you to, I guess, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you fell in love with music and you know, why you decided to work in the radio business on a daily basis.
Other than my love of being a multi-instrumentalist, Kel. no, but thank you for that. I've always just loved music. I've totally identified with music, lyrically, harmonically. It's always just spoken to me, and it sounds really clinical just saying that, but it's always been like I have musical memories, things that take me back to being 7 years old or younger, or, oh, yeah, I remember we did that. It's just a trigger from a song or a note or a line of a song that'll just get me. And it's always been like that. So I felt really fortunate that I was able to sort of follow that a little bit and make it a career.
You're one of, you know, only a few people that I know that truly enjoys most types of music. You're not one to sort of get stuck in, you know, one realm. Why do you think you appreciate so many different styles?
I think it's because of all those things like the lyrics, or I'm a huge fan of harmony. So if something grabs me that way, it doesn't matter if it's like a Beach Boys song or if it's a Megadeth song, if there's something in it that's making me go, huh, then I think that's the key to a successful songwriter and a successful song.
Now, you and I both obviously are on the radio, and it's a very fickle business on occasion. You never know if you're going to stay in the same city or move around and all that sort of stuff. And I think a lot of people wonder why we do what we do, because as much fun as it is to play, you know, tunes all day long, again, you know, our schedules might be all over the place and all that sort of stuff. But I know that personally speaking, you know, one of the reasons I love being on the air so much is knowing that we are really affecting listeners with the music that we play. So I wanted to ask you, you know, as a radio announcer, how have you witnessed, you know, firsthand the power of music in your listeners' lives?
I think that the people that listen to Shom sort of are the heritage listener. They've been listening for a long time. And if they're younger, the younger listener is listening because of their father or their older brother, or it's just something that has been on for them and they just identify with it. And I think, you know, games like Rock Band or any of those Grand Theft Auto style games that have implemented music as a major part of the game have really done a lot for a heritage radio station like Shom. So we've permeated their existence almost, and it becomes less like work every time I'm on. You're just communicating with people because you seem to have something in common. I may have zero in common with them actually, but the fact that we are connecting over the songs it gives us quite a bit in common.
Now, can you explain, I guess, to our listeners, because we have, you know, so many listeners listening overseas right now, and we mentioned again that SHOM is a heritage station and that it's one of North America's premier rock stations. Can you just explain a little bit of the history of SHOM, though, and why it is what it is? Because unless you maybe not know about it, it really is, you know, in so many people's fabrics of their lives, whether you live in Montreal or not.
It's true. It's just been, it seems like it's been around forever, and it started as an AM station. It got its FM license. It grew sort of, I guess, in the same way that people approach it now. The people that work there anyways approach it now. The people that I work with are somewhat different than anybody I've ever worked with. They know that they're bringing themselves to the job, and it's just sort of something that a lot of people grew up listening to the station, so now they're like, hey, I get to work there. But it's one of those things that back in the, you know, throughout the 70s, where people, the joke is, oh, yeah, I brought my own record, and I'm just going to play side one. It's a joke now, because the way commercial radio is programmed, that's not going to happen. But back then, they dropped the needle, and they went outside for a smoke. And they came back, and a lot of times the side was over, and there was dead air for a while, but they sort of were able to position it in a way that, well, that was just part of the experience, the dead air. Sorry about that. On to the next thing. There were rules for sure, but almost like there was no rules, and people like that sort of rebellious nature of something like that. And again, they identify with it because it sounds fun. You're introducing them to all different kinds of rock music, and they like that. And I mean, bands' success that can trace themselves back to SHOM include Genesis, includes Supertramp, includes Styx. These are all like household names now, major classic rock references that would tour North America, let's say, and elsewhere outside of Montreal would be doing club shows. Then they'd come to Montreal and sell out the Forum for two nights. So they those bands themselves know that they have huge fan bases and a place in the hearts of Montreal listeners because of that early success. There's something about it that grabbed them, and it traces back to SHOM because we were the only station playing them.
Joining us on the show right now is our music editor, Sharon Hyland. You can follow her, by the way, on Twitter, @TheSharonHyland. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about, I guess, a trend that I've been noticing the last little while with older musicians, if I can call them that, because they are older than some of the 20-year-olds.
They're not here.
Exactly. And I find that they're starting to work with, you know, young, you know, up-and-coming pop and dance producers, you know, on these new songs. For example, Mick Jagger, you know, working with Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas, and then Elton John recently, you know, teaming up with an Australian dance team known as Panao. And, you know, I know they've sort of been connected for a while, Elton and these Australians, but it's only sort of coming to light now, this big project that they've been working on. And are you sort of surprised at these collaborations?
You know what? Elton John specifically, I know is a fan of music, period. I've read articles about him and stories about him, and he's always said that every once in a while, he'll just go shopping for CDs and look for, you know, new artists just to sort of be aware of what's going on in his industry. He wants to know what's happening, what sounds good, what people are listening to. And if that relates to what he's interested in doing, then great. It just keeps him aware, which I think is really important as a person in his business. But at the same time, he's an artist, so he's interested in the art. He's interested in finding out new things. It doesn't surprise me at all that he would be sort of outgoing with regard to maintaining his own interest in music. As far as teaming up with a dance team, I mean, we know he's done Broadway stuff and written songs specifically for shows like that. So, no, I'm not totally surprised by that. And same deal with Mick Jagger. And Will.i.am has established himself as, you know, a go-to guy, real, like, get the job done kind of guy. And so for someone like Mick Jagger, 69-year-old Mick Jagger, it's not so far-fetched that he would hook up with someone younger, because he's had so many years creating himself that he would want to still create. I don't think you lose that spark to create music. And so if you see that this guy, Will.i.am, is doing something pretty cool, even if it's outside of what you're known for, music-wise, it's kind of neat to collaborate and come up with something different.
Now, with Elton, I think you pretty much explained this, but I wanted to get your opinion, I guess, on other people. Do you think the fact that these older musicians are working with these younger guys, is this an attempt to stay, I don't even want to use this word, but I'm just going to, for purposes of this interview, are they trying to stay relevant, or do you think they are truly interested in learning about and trying this, you know, fresh dance kind of sound?
I don't think that someone like Elton John is worried about relevance. Really, honestly, it's this this many years later into his career, I think he's just got a keen interest in the art of it. Because, I mean, if we look back at his last few albums, they've done well. They've not done the same amount of well that they did, like, throughout the 70s or like that kind of time. But he's making the music to make the music. I think he loves the music.
And do you think that their older audiences are going to think that these artists are selling out, you know, and maybe will turn their backs on them? Or do you think it's just two separate entities?
I think it could be both. I think there's probably a handful of people. I think there's always a handful of people that always want to cry the sellout. But at this point, I think if anybody's going to say that Elton John is a sellout, I think Elton John himself would say, yep. You know what? I mean, he's superstar quality, right? He's up there. He's done it all. And I mean, I think his biggest issue would be having to find a babysitter with his young family. So it's kind of a funny contradiction. He's considered an older artist, but he's also a brand new daddy. So he's got to get a babysitter if he's going to be working so much.
Now, do you think that this trend of the older and the younger working together is going to continue? Or do you think that this is something that's, you know, purely experimental and a few artists will try it, but then say two?
No, I think it'll continue, because I think even the younger artists are definitely affected and inspired by the older ones that have come before them. So it's a mutual respect of wanting to work with and see what they, as a younger professional, can get out of this artist that they've admired for as long as they've had.
Now, I happen to know that you are a fan of original music and are not really into the remixes. but I wanted to ask you what you think of Elton, you know, handing over his catalog between 1970 and 1976 and letting these, you know, young guys from Australia, you know, have at it on their project called Good Morning to the Night.
Well, you know what? I think that it proves exactly that he is the artist that he is. Here, take it. I've done it. I'm done with it. It's a hit. People like it. Let's see what you can do with it. I like the idea of it. And yeah, you can bug me all you like about not liking remixes. I'm just sort of a fan of the original. If the song is a hit and I like it, even if it's not a hit and I like it, then someone else takes it. It may not suit me. So if it doesn't suit me within the same, like, 2-minute window, let's say, or 3-minute window, and if they've extended it into a 7-minute window, there's three times the reason why I'm not going to be a fan of it.
I see. But, and then my question for you then would be, is it just the remix that's the problem for you? Or, for example, right now, you know, George Michael has been on his Symphonica tour, you know, before he got sick and all that sort of stuff. So they were doing different arrangements of his hit songs that were, you know, dance pop and all that kind of stuff. And sort of taking it in this, like, you know, orchestral big band type of thing that he's got going on. Are you okay with them themselves rearranging it into that form? Or is it just the dance music that you don't like?
I guess, you know what, if asked that question, I think it might depend on my mood of the day, because I sort of think, okay, well, you're just taking your songs and you're just making them slightly different, but are you in fact creating new music? Mm-hmm. You know, like, so if you're interested in making new music, then have at her, go and make some new music. But is that new music, or is it just tweaked up versions of your other stuff? And no criticism. I love George Michael. I have respect for all the artists that make music. I think my reference point would be Bon Jovi and their album. I think it was called This Left Sounds Right. And it was all songs that were previously done and then redone. This was years ago. And we know that there's been like at least 4 albums since then. And you think, okay, well, you weren't done being creative. How come you had to take those ones and rework them just slightly? It just sort of sounded to me at the time as somewhat self-serving.
Okay. Gotcha.
But, you know, at the same time, it's their art. They can do what they want. That's just my opinion.
Joining us on the show, our new music editor, Sharon Hyland. Again, follow her on Twitter at the Sharon Hyland. Now, the big news in the last little while has been the speculation over American Idol. And we finally got the news that Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez have pressed the eject button and they are leaving the show. And right now, I think it's up in the air if Randy Jackson is actually going to say, you know, to stay on. So I wanted your thoughts on that, in the fact that, do you think the show should continue? Do you think Stephen and Jennifer did a good job? And if you do think the show should continue, who would you put in those seats?
I thought it was important that they had brought in new judges when they did. I wasn't a fan of four judges on that show. I didn't see a reason why Ellen DeGeneres would have been the fourth judge, claiming to be the voice of the people. No offense to her, I'm a fan of hers also, but I don't think she's the voice of the people. She's a superstar herself who has no music career. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I need a superstar to be the voice of me. I think my voice should count, or sorry, not my voice, but my vote should count as, you know, speaking for the people. Having said that, I think that it was important to change up the judges and add a Jennifer Lopez and a Steven Tyler. Whether they should have added them specifically, I don't know. I think it worked for the show this year. It was fun to watch. Yet at the same time, feedback-wise, it seemed that a lot of the focus was on Jennifer crying because she couldn't tell someone they weren't going to be able to do it. And so it becomes less about the contestant and more about the judge,
right,
not being able to do it. And that bothered me, because these people have to sort of go through their own nerves and sort of be tough about it. Meanwhile, she's blubbering away because she doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. It's not about her. And Steven Tyler, I love him. I think he's great. I don't remember much about what he said constructively to a lot of the contestants. So it was like, you're beautiful. That was beautiful. And then, you know, if we went back over the season to count how many times he said something was beautiful, and then contrasted that to the number of creepy feelings we got when he was, like, making that look at a young girl, I think we'd have a lot of weird emotions.
So we're happy we're done with them. Would you put someone, would you put someone else on?
Well, now we're hearing talks about Mariah Carey and Aretha Franklin. So is it American Idol or is it American Diva? Because that's a totally different show.
Right, yeah.
And I think Mariah Carey could pull it off. I don't know that. I think Aretha Franklin, I love her to death too. I think that she might be not only the queen of soul, but she might be the queen of the divas.
Right. Okay.
And can you rely on that?
Yeah.
You know, is it relevant to someone? I don't know. It should be relevant because of her own experience and because of what she brings to the table. But I'm not sure. Like,
your
I don't
thoughts
know.
On
Maybe
Mariah,
the show's
though.
Done.
Like, your thoughts on Mariah, just a question about her, because, I mean, she is technically such an amazing singer, and we all know how hard she is on herself in the fact that, mm-hmm. you know, if you follow music at all and follow pop music or R&B, you know that she's infamous for having, like, insomnia and staying in the studio for hours at a time. And maybe she's a bit better now because she's got the kids. But do you think, like, how do you think she would come off? Do you think she would end up crying like J-Lo?
No, I don't. I think she'd be real about it. I think she's had some life experience, and not that J-Lo hasn't had any life experience. I think it's just different. I think that she's grown up a little bit differently, and I think that she'd be able to, because she's been a mentor, I think that she could coach them properly if they wanted that to happen. But I just wonder if the show is even supposed to have such seasoned veterans as judges, when the nature of the word idol, it's not long lasting.
Right.
You know, like anybody that you compare to being an idol, let's say throughout the 50s, even 60s, 70s, 80s, it's a short term gig. All these people want long term success, but they're going through it, you know, the idol way. And that's sort of like you're almost putting a block in front of yourself by doing that.
Do you
in
think,
my opinion,
in your opinion, do you think Randy Jackson is done?
I thought he had his best year, to tell you the truth.
Because he was like in charge, kind of?
Sorry?
Because he was, like, in charge, kind of?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was clearer than ever. He had his moments of cuckoo-ness also, but I don't know. Are they supposed to keep him? Would that be communicating to him that he is the anchor of the show?
Well, word has it that he might be done. But the thing is, with me, I'm thinking that if they do bring Mariah Carey on, him and her are great buds, have worked together forever, and, you know, he might be part of the reason she actually comes on. So I'm not sure, you know, if he will stay or not stay, and if people are done with him. Like, I'm kind of done with him, and I'm just not sure if other people are as well.
And the funny thing is that this year, talent-wise, as per the judges' table, there was a lot of it. You know, and Randy comes with all his session work and all his, not behind the scenes, but he's not a superstar. Whereas J-Lo is happy to be a superstar, and she used the show probably more than it used her, because each season that she did it, she had a new single to sing about or to talk about. Steven Tyler used his own band's drama to, he used Idol to escape that, and then used Idol to bring the band back together and intro their first new song in however many years.
Wow.
So I don't know. I don't know if the show's done. I don't know who the show's to be serving anymore, if this is what they've got at the on the panel.
And something I've always wanted to ask you, and we've never actually talked about this, so this will be interesting for me to hear, in the fact that I don't think you and I have ever discussed who would be your favorite winner in, you know, in all these seasons. Like, I can straight up tell you I'm a huge Kelly Clarkson fan.
Same here.
Okay.
Same here. I think she's done it the best out of all of them, because she had her win. She did what she was supposed to do as far as requirements with the show. She sort of dropped out for a little while, and then she came back.
Mm-hmm.
She never changed anything. She stayed true to herself, but she didn't have to fall under the moniker of Idol. Yeah, she was the first winner,
mm-hmm.
but she is her own person now. She's established. She's countered what the definition of Idol would have you think. So she's got a greater chance at longer term success, I think, than anybody else yet.
Which is interesting in the fact that, like you mentioned, she is the first winner. So it's almost like they got it right the first season.
Exactly. And how many now?
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for hanging out with us, and you'll be back on the show, you know, very quickly.
Oh, yes, I will.
And that's a threat. a big thank you to our music editor, Sharon Hyland. And again, make sure you follow her on Twitter at The Sharon Hyland. And you can also check her out on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
It's vacation season, and many of us are setting out for our favorite travel destinations or starting to think about where we're going to escape to once the winter rolls around. For many of us, traveling is a joy. After a little planning, we hop on a plane or jump in the car, and we cannot wait to get there. But for those with reduced mobility and their families, traveling takes a lot more planning and may even seem a little bit of a nightmare. Here to help us get a handle on traveling with reduced mobility is accessible travel expert Candy Harrington. Candy, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Candy, who are we actually talking about when we say a traveler with reduced mobility?
Well, it can be anybody from somebody that's in a wheelchair full time to somebody that just needs to sit down and rest and perhaps needs help through the airport and can't do distances. So it's a really broad range of people.
Now, what are some of the problems, I guess, that travelers with reduced mobility actually run into?
Well, first and foremost, I have to say is when you travel, if you have a wheelchair, it's really hard to find, in some places, to find accessible transportation, meaning a taxi cab or something that can accommodate a wheelchair or even a tour. So you really do have to shop around for those, and that's unfortunately a problem, but we're getting more and more accessible vehicles around, so it is improving.
What are some of the, I guess, the best vacation choices, you know, for someone who might walk very slow or, you know, is a wheelchair user?
Well, you know, cruises are always a good choice because you get on a ship. Most of the ships now, the larger ships, the newer ships, they've done a really good job with access. And you can even rent a wheelchair and have it delivered to your cabin if you so choose. So you don't want, if you don't, you know, not a full-time wheelchair user, just need it for distance. And you can find shore excursions that are wheelchair accessible, but again, you do have to shop around. Still, a lot of people just love the whole cruise experience.
What are your thoughts on airports? Have a lot of airports upgraded to dealing with these issues?
Airports are usually pretty good. The TSA, you know, our security is coming around to be more mindful of people with access issues. And, you know, we have the kinder, gentler TSA now. So that's improving. Airplanes themselves, the biggest problem is lack of accessible restrooms. Very few have what you would call a truly accessible restroom.
And is that the same, you know, on a train, perhaps?
Some of the longer train trips, larger trains, do have accessible restrooms that you can actually get in a wheelchair, but a lot of them don't. So, again, you have to kind of, you know, ask and look at the train that you're traveling on, too.
If you are on a train that is going, you know, cross country or whatever, where you are going to be spending the night, are these good options for, travelers with reduced mobility?
Well, in the U.S., Amtrak does have staterooms or actually cabins, sleeper cars that are wheelchair accessible. You really have to get those in advance, too, because they're, you know, few. They go fast and they're few and far between. But most people plan train trips well in advance anyway. Via Rail does have some limited access also in Canada. But again, you just really have to, it depends on the train route that you take.
On the show with us this week is accessible travel expert Candy Harrington. Make sure to check out her blog page, barrierfreetravels.com. Candy, what are some of the world's, or I guess, you know, the cities around the world that are accessible cities? What do they have that other cities do not?
Well, you know, I think one of my favorite accessible cities is San Diego, California. They have a little group there called Access San Diego that's really proactive, and they started networking with the hotels and the attractions. So they've made everything more accessible, and they have an access guide to tell people where they can go and what they can do. And so that's, San Diego is always my model of a great city with good access. And I have to say the weather is always 80 degrees there too, so that just really helps out a lot.
And do you have any other accessible cities that you can just sort of mention just so that people have this in their heads?
Well, you know, Florida is a good choice. Orlando, of course, a lot of people like to go to the theme parks, but there's a lot more things to do besides the theme parks in Orlando. I also like Nashville. And actually, London is very accessible. They are one of the few cities in the world that has 100% of their taxi cabs are wheelchair accessible. So if you're thinking of going to the Olympics, it's a good choice.
Wow, that's awesome. I had no idea about that. Now, if you are thinking of planning a multi-generational trip, you know, the grandkids, the grandparents, the parents, how do you go about picking these so that the whole family feels, you know, complete and in a good mood?
Well, I think you have to kind of get together first and decide what everyone wants to do. I like car trips for multi-generational travel because you can stop whenever you want. If the kids are getting a little antsy, you know, they can get out and walk around and blow off some steam. And they're also a really good choice for anybody that has a mobility issue because, again, you can take things at your own pace. You're not on somebody else's schedule.
And do you suggest if you are going on a road trip, you know, with the multi-generational thing, that you might have two or three cars, because let's say the kids are getting annoying, maybe grandpa and granny want to go ahead a little bit or go get coffee or something like that?
Certainly. I know a lot of people that do it just that way. You know, you can split up, and sometimes grandma and grandpa want to take the kids and give the parents a break for, you know, a few hours too. So I think that's a great idea too.
What qualities do you look for in accessible accommodations?
Well, basically, I look for pathway access, barrier-free access, to make sure there are no steps anywhere. Even if it's just a 6-inch step, it may as well be Mount Everest if you can't walk at all if you're in a wheelchair. Also, you know, look for wide doorways in hotels and bathrooms that have roll-in showers and grab bars, and toilets that have grab bars as well.
What advice do you have for, you know, hotel and business owners who are looking to make things easier for travelers with reduced mobility?
I would say to put a good description of what your rooms are like, because the word accessible means just different things to different people. So I always advise them to just put it on the web and tell people exactly what you have so they can make appropriate choices.
Now, if you have a family that is dealing with a child with, you know, reduced mobility, are there, you know, tips for them, advice for them about how to work through this?
Well, children are a little more difficult in one sense, that if you grow up and you have a child that's got a mobility disability, They're in a stroller for a long time anyway. And, you know, parents just aren't used to planning for the kid not being in a stroller. So they tend to overlook things. I think you can't just say, oh, he's just small, he's in a stroller. I think you have to look as hard for accessible things as somebody who's an adult, you know.
You know, I think there's a big talk, or there's, you know, there's a lot of concern, or I guess just a thought process about, you know, baby boomers, like they are getting older. Is this going to really change the travel industry, like depending on how their mobility goes as they get older?
Well, yeah, I've seen that in just my work in the last 15 years. A lot of small inns, for example, are making their facilities accessible because they want everybody to be able to come there. They do a lot of wedding business, and they don't want grandma or grandpa to be left out. And they know that if they can't accommodate everybody, then customers are just going to take their business elsewhere, and they don't want to lose that business.
In your latest book, 22 Accessible Road Trips, you obviously write a lot about accessible road trips in particular. How should we tackle road trips, I guess, differently than other means of travel if you are trying to do this as a reduced mobility situation?
Well, I think, of course, you have to look for the accessible things along the way. But I also tell people to give themselves plenty of time, because that's the great part about a road trip for access, is that if you're having a bad day, that you can take the day off, you can sleep in, you can take it slower. So don't make it a killer schedule for you. Just, you know, give yourself time.
And what do you say to families that are dealing with reduced mobility, whereby it might be a new thing for them? Like maybe, you know, this is the first year that grandma can't get around, or this is the first year we realize that, you know, little Johnny has problems and, you know, can't walk, you know, like the rest of the family. Is there a way for the family to feel like this isn't going to be some sort of travesty each and every year if they want to go on vacation?
Well, you know, I tell people that are first-timers, just start out slow and just, like, maybe take an overnight trip that's in driving distance to your own home. So if you panic and things go terribly wrong, you at least have a safety net there for your first trip. And then, you know, you'll pick up things that you need to do for your own self along the way. So, but, yeah, just start out slow. That's a really good way to do it.
And have you noticed with families that are dealing with reduced mobility issues that when they do, you know, go through vacation for the first time, or maybe even the 15th time, that it really does maybe just help their home life?
It is. Travel is very empowering because it just shows you that you can be independent. And, you know, aside from going someplace and seeing things and having fun, it really gives you the you know, big boost in your self-confidence. It's like, yeah, I did that. I can do a lot of things, you know. So, yeah, I would definitely say so.
Now, you've written, several books on accessible travel. Where can people get their hands on this, especially if this is something that, you know, they're just getting into?
Well, they're all over the internet, but basically, if you go to my blog at barrierfreetravels.com, you can link to any of the books, and you can buy them on Amazon. You can buy them on any place you want to nowadays. So check out my blog.
And as we sort of roll forward, you know, we're in 2012 right now, and you know, heading down the road here. Do you think there will be improvements in accessible travel?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've started this 15 years ago, started covering it 15 years ago, and the change in just 15 years has been amazing. I had a friend, he says 25 years ago when he went on vacation, the only way he could get to an airport is in an ambulance, and he's in a wheelchair. So, and just today, I mean, you can call Super Shuttle and they're wheelchair accessible. So huge changes, yes.
Fantastic. Well, Candy, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's accessible travel expert Candy Harrington. Again, make sure to check out her blog, barrierfreetravels.com.
Bring on the remix.
That's Madonna with Turn Up the Radio, the George M. Radio remix on The Kelly Alexander Show. Don't forget to check out our brand new website. We are very excited about it, kellyalexandershow.com. You can let us know what you think. You can send me an email, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. And also, we are looking forward to more followers on Twitter, our new account, @KellyAlexanderShow. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.